This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Throughout history, there have been times of mass famine until this century. Children today have hardly heard that word in the news. That may be about to change. Joel K. Bourne, Jr. is one of the top agriculture journalists. His work appears regularly in National Geographic and other publications. His new book is The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Joel Bourne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's nice to be here.
Well, ever since Malthus in the 1700s and up to the Ehrlichs in the 1970s, people have been warning there's an upper limit to the food we can make on this planet, yet we seem to be feeding billions more people. Why should we pay attention to the idea of peak food now?
Very good question. And of course, when we're here in the United States in the land of plenty, it's with the grocery stores shelves still full, it's kind of curious to talk about world hunger. And yet, what we've seen since the turn of the century in 2000, we started to gradually see demand outstripping supply. So in the first 12 years since 2000, we actually consumed or otherwise utilized more of the three major grain crops, rice, wheat, and corn, than we actually grew in 8 out of the 12 years, the first 12 years of this century, which was part of the thing that triggered the enormous volatility of food prices that occurred in 2008 and again in 2010 and again in 2012. So what we're starting to see is very highly volatile food prices based on this relationship, but where our demand from population growth, increased meat consumption, and our increased use of grain for biofuels is putting a lot of pressure on our global grain supplies.
It sounds like a simple, almost stupid question, but how could humans consume more food than we produce?
Oh, well, because every year we typically produce more than we need, and we put it in storage, essentially. We have overages on good years that we store. And so what happened was we have been whittling down our stockpiles to some of the lowest levels we've seen since the 1970s, when about a quarter of the world's people were hungry. And this is another thing that causes markets to flutter, because when they see the stockpiles getting down to 68, 70 days of supply, then it makes the investors start to really worry and starts the prices to rise. So, again, we're not talking about eating more than we grow. We're talking about using up the old grain from the previous year.
So one person who's been keenly watching grain supplies is Lester Brown. He founded the World Watch Institute and then the Earth Policy Institute. Has Brown affected your own work?
Oh, absolutely. He was one of the inspirations for this. He's one of the few people who've really taken a hard look at agriculture and its impact, not just on ecosystems, but the climate and on population and on our economy. And, of course, Brown was the first one to raise the flag about who's going to feed China in the early 1990s. And I spend an entire chapter in the book talking about China's incredibly stringent growth in meat demand, where they're eating more and more hogs every year as their population increases in wealth and more of their people move into the middle class. They tend to eat more meat, and their meat consumption has almost doubled in the last decade alone, and it's projected to keep on growing. Same with India, although there they're eating more dairy. And when people eat more meat and more dairy, it's a multiplier effect for grain, because these livestock tend to be fed either corn or wheat in many parts of the world. So that's part of the problem. And, of course, Lester Brown has been on it, oh, gosh, since the 1960s, yeah.
I think one good example that you write about is Egypt's food problem. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Egypt is one of these incredible examples. It's sort of the world food problem in a nutshell. So Egypt used to grow enough wheat to feed all its people in the 1960s, even enough to start even export wheat to some of its neighbors. But because of population growth in Egypt has almost quadrupled since the 1960s, their farmers were just unable to keep up. Now, Egypt eats more wheat per capita than any other nation in the world. They are so dependent on it, they call it Aish, which is their word for life. And as a result, they have become one of the greatest or the largest importer of wheat on the planet. And so they are so dependent on the world grain markets that when we saw the big fluctuations in wheat prices, where they tripled in 2008 to the highest inflation-adjusted price since World War I, We saw bread lines in Egypt. We saw food riots. Several people died in the scramble to get subsidized bread that the army, they had to call in the army to and the army bakeries to make for the people. It was just a tragic food crisis, and it was not the only country that experienced it. Several, about a dozen other countries had food riots around the world that year.
You know, Joel, we've had scientists on this show say that climate change may have begun almost 10,000 years ago with the development of agriculture, but how is modern agriculture adding to climate change?
Great question. And I talked to a couple of chapters of this in the book. Because of the way we currently farm, with our heavy petroleum invested agriculture, you know, most of our fertilizers derive from ammonia and natural gas, as well as other that's mined. It's very chemical, very oil intensive. We are actually contributing the whole food production system a third of global emissions every year. We are literally farming ourselves out of food this way. And this is why. A study came out a few years ago on looking at the projecting the impacts of climate change on our ability to grow food for ourselves. This is from the Royal Society in London, one of the oldest scientific groups in the world. And they projected if we get to a 4 degrees Celsius increase, which our emissions are currently on track to do by the end of the century, it could make half of our agricultural land either less suitable or even unsuitable for agricultural use. So at that point, our population is projected to be 11.2 billion people. So that's adding 4 billion more people on the planet, four more Chinas, four more Indias. So feeding that many more people with half the available agricultural land is one of those real facts that just studies that I sort of stood up and said, wow, this can't happen. There's no way these numbers can meet, and we have to do something about it, or else millions upon millions of people are going to find themselves in very, very dire straits.
Well, I've seen maps showing how deserts may spread around the subtropics, and that includes the U.S. Southwest. But also, rising seas could flood some of the world's most productive and populated river deltas. Did you look into that?
We did. You know, places like Bangladesh, where so many people live in these flood-prone areas and where so much rice is produced for these countries, they are in the crosshairs of climate change. The other thing we look at in the book is the melting of the glaciers, the great Asiatic glaciers in the Himalayas, all of which are losing mass. And they feed, you know, they are the main water supply for these tremendous rivers that irrigate vast swaths of Asia. You know, fully half of Asia is fed by the meltwaters of these rivers that are disappearing because the glaciers are melting. So these are other ways where water is becoming increasingly constrained around the world, both for irrigation, but also as sea levels rise, flooding these incredibly important delta areas that produce the bulk of Asia's rice. Yes, they're sort of caught in a vice in that way.
Vegans and vegetarians claim meat is a big part of the world food problem, and you alluded to that already. Could you enlarge on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned one study in the book that says if you feed your average family of four a hamburger dinner, it's like taking them for a 100-mile ride in your car. The emissions and the grain needed to and grain and water needed to grow cattle particularly is incredibly high. It's one of the least efficient ways to produce animal protein. So we talk about, you know, one of the easiest and simplest things we could do to reduce our demand on the planet as well as the food supply is to eat less meat, particularly red meat like beef. The good news is aquaculture, which I've written a whole chapter on, can be done in a very sustainable way, particularly when you grow omnivorous fish that don't require small pelagic fish for feed. Incredibly efficient way to grow very healthy animal protein that's delicious and healthful, full of omega-3 fatty acids, everything that we need if we can just sort of transition off the hamburgers and on to the fish sticks. You know, if you can get population to move in that direction, we'll do ourselves all a great favor.
Well, we have a lot of aquaculture in British Columbia, but it has polluted some of our fjords, and there are some difficulties with the Atlantic salmon being raised in the Pacific escaping. So are there ways that we can get around the drawbacks to our present form of aquaculture?
Oh, absolutely. And again, most people are sort of scared of aquaculture because of the experience they've had both with shrimp farms in the tropics tearing up mangroves, as well as the salmon farms, you know, growing exotic species in areas with all this escapement and disease. But there are many ways we can grow fish that are both fish and shellfish that are actually beneficial to our local coastal environments. And actually, I did mention in the aquaculture chapter, a researcher at the University of Vancouver who's looking at this thing called integrated multitrophic aquaculture, where he's grown about 12 native species in one experimental aquaculture farm, a former salmon farm. And all of them are sort of feeding off the waste of the other. So he's feeding one species, which is black cod, delicious fish, very highly prized, surrounding the pens with sugar kelp, growing lantern baskets full of scallops, and even has sea cucumbers on the bottom, sort of hoovering up the waste that everything else has left behind. So this wonderful sort of cyclic route, I call it like an aquatic organic garden, where he's got a number of different species that he's producing that are all living very low on the food chain and also helping to clean the water as they do it. So there are many ways we can produce fish and shellfish that actually clean up local waters. Shellfish, oyster farming in particular, is a great way, and mussel farming, to get sediment and nutrients out of the water.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Joel K. Bourne, author of the new book, The End of Plenty. We're talking about the food you eat. Well, Joel, we talked about climate change, and one big driver of that is deforestation. Is that all due to demand for wood and paper, or is food also behind deforestation as well?
Well, food is a huge driver, Alex. And one of the chapters when I talk about, we're looking at the enormous increase in hog production in China. China no longer grows enough grain to feed both its people and its hogs. So they've moved on to the market en masse to buy soybeans from places like Brazil and Argentina, where the soy revolution just rolled in to Mato Grosso and some of these areas in Brazil that moved the cattlemen out and into the Amazon and contributed to this incredible deforestation we saw there in the 1990s. Now, it slowed in the 2000s to 2010s. We got it down to about 13 million hectares a year, still apocryphal, but, you know, lower than it was. But only recently, as the price of soybeans rose, we started to see deforestation increase again in Latin America. And again, that's unsustainable. There's no way we can do that. Now, if we don't increase our production, and scientists now say that we need to almost double the amount of grain that we're currently producing by 2050. If we don't do that, then the other alternative is to expand into these forested areas, and some estimates had put that as much as 1 billion to 1.5 billion hectares of new land that will be coming out of the forest, and of course that would be a terrible thing for our climate.
How big a factor are biofuels in diverting food production into our cars, and is it just happening in the United States?
Biofuels are a huge factor. I mean, we're currently dumping 40% of the U.S. corn crop, and the United States is the Saudi Arabia of corn. We're dumping 40% of our corn crop into our cars through corn-based ethanol, and that's enough grain, to put it in perspective, to feed everyone in Africa for a year. It's an enormous amount of grain and also enormous amount of land that's being taken out of food production. In Europe, of course, they run mostly diesel vehicles. They're doing very similar things through these government mandates with things like rapeseed, canola oil, sunflower oil that is displacing land that once grew wheat. So again, these things are shoving food grains aside and increasing prices so that they're now actually making food prices directly linked to fuel prices on the world markets, which is not a great way to go. Now, everyone has said, oh, well, this is just a transition. We're going to move out of these crops and into second-generation biofuels that don't compete with food crops. But unfortunately, that just hasn't happened. 90 to 95% of all the biofuel produced in the United States comes from corn ethanol still. And unfortunately, the second-generation biofuels have not made a dent in our massive biofuel mandate. So weaning ourselves off food grade and biofuels is one of the easiest and best things we can do.
One of the big themes of your National Geographic article and the book, both titled The End of Plenty, is the role of the Green Revolution. But was it really green in the environmental sense of the word?
Not at all. It was green, it was labeled green by the head of USAID at the time, who was referring to the greening of the fields. But it was in no way green as we think of that today in terms of environmental environmental impacts. It was a double-edged sword. Even though it produced an enormous amount of food and basically went, you know, we went from having about 30% of our global population in constant hunger to about 12% today, the environmental impacts were severe. We've got enormous groundwater and estuary pollution from all the fertilizers we're dumping on our bread baskets. We've got pesticide pollution that's contaminating groundwater and causing horrible health effects in places like India, where I reported on in the book. And, you know, it's just the water use has just been dramatic. People think of the Green Revolution as high-yielding seeds, fertilizers, and pesticides, but none of them work very effectively without irrigation. And what we've seen is enormous drawdowns of our groundwater aquifers thanks to the irrigation that was promulgated by the Green Revolution. So we're seeing constraints and impacts on all those fronts.
You know, few people are aware that British Petroleum put out a report saying that affordable gas and oil that companies could really use and make money on will be gone in 50 years. What does that mean to these projections for world food production?
You know, that's really interesting. When they talk about affordable, because, you know, many of my colleagues reported on the peak oil phenomenon that they thought was going to happen in 2000, and that was right before fracking and all these different types of deep water oil resources came online, and suddenly now oil is cheaper than it's been in 30 years. So some of these projections have gone by the wayside. But certainly our energy demand is very closely connected to our food demand. One of the chapters in the book I focus on is organic agriculture, which are using much fewer fuels, much less energy to grow basic crops that are competitively in yield to conventional crops. So there are ways we can farm that is not so energy intensive, but it's also better for the planet and better for our water supplies for sure.
Are genetically modified crops going to save us from a world food crisis?
Well, you know, when I was at NC State, these were touted as the miracle crops. The technology was just coming out in the early 1980s when I was in ag school, and my professors were sort of beside themselves with what these things were going to do for us, right? We're going to be able to vaccinate all the children in the world from treatable diseases with carrying the vaccines and the foods they ate. You know, we're going to be able to reduce nutrient deficiencies by putting the nutrients in the staple crops. And here we are 35 years later, and we've got two blockbuster traits from GMOs. We've got the Roundup Ready transgene and the BT transgene. And they're both, while they haven't caused the great environmental or health problems that we were afraid of, they haven't done an enormous amount of good. They've helped us reduce the amount of toxic pesticides we sprayed on crops like cotton, and they've helped with some soil erosion issues in the Midwest by allowing us to farm no-till with Roundup. But, you know, we're already starting to see resistance to these pesticides and herbicides, and now the big companies like Monsanto are starting to breed new things that are resistant to older, more toxic chemicals like 2,4-D, which is really almost like going backwards. These chemicals have been around since the 1950s and 60s, so it's really not the right way to go. However, the technology is getting so much cheaper. It's now becoming in the realm of the land-grant researchers, the nonprofit researchers, who are just now starting to use that technology to make crops that benefit poor farmers in Asia and they have great public benefits. So I think the technology is powerful. We have to use it, view it on a case-by-case basis. But I think it's too promising to just put on a shelf and say, you know, we're not going to do this. The problems ahead of us are so large, I think we're going to need every tool in the toolbox to address them.
You know, a lot of people in the West presume that famine or at least persistent hunger may reappear in faraway places like Asia or Africa. But we've just seen a scientific study showing that the drought in Syria starting around 2006 drove a lot of farmers off the land. And maybe that's part of the refugee crisis we're seeing in Europe right now. So food is now so global, it can all come back to us one way or another, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I think once we're looking at the true causes of what's happening in Europe, whether it's through Syria or Afghanistan, if you look at Yemen, you look at any of these countries, food security is almost at the rock bottom. They're having an extremely difficult time feeding themselves. Parts of the Horn of Africa that are moving up through Libya, same problem. They're having enormous problems. And this is not only a food security issue, but it's, as we see in Europe, it's becoming a national security issue. And one of the gentlemen I interviewed and who blogged for the book was General Hugh Shelton, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States, who recognizes this. He was in Sarajevo in Yugoslavia, and he saw these what hunger can do to people and how desperate it makes them. And I think we're seeing some of that now. Unless we can come up with a better way to farm, to help these communities, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, feed their people better, then I think this is just the beginning. We're going to see a lot of migration, a lot of people trying to get out of areas that can no longer sustain them to places that can. And I don't think the United States is going to be immune. We'll see a lot of the same thing in Latin America, South America, with people trying to come north.
Well, on the other hand, tell us about a couple of the more positive solutions that you've found popping up around the world.
Yeah, the first part of the book really looks at the great challenges, the hurdles we have to feed everybody equitably by 2050. And the last half of the book really looks at these solutions. So one of the great ones, of course, is yield gaps. Places like the United States, Europe, Australia, China have enormously high yields, partly based on the Green Revolution paradigm, but also partly based on what some of the organic growers are doing. Now, other places like sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia that I mentioned earlier, have very low yields, pathetic yields. And yet with technology we have off the shelf, either agroecological or conventional, we can help those people grow an enormous amount of more food just by getting them up to sort of the world average for their maize yields or their wheat yields or their rice yields. Now, irrigation. Well, we talk a lot about that in the book in terms of using micro-hydro, or what we call our micro-irrigation, that's now becoming very cost-effective for even the poorest farmers to use, which has a 90% efficiency. So even if you've got a limited amount of water, you can use that very effectively to help increase your yields. And irrigated cropland yields 2 to 3 times that of rain-fed cropland. So it's an easy way to do that. Not easy, not cheap all the time, but certainly effective, and if we can help them do that. We can certainly cut out grain-based biofuels. Man, that's low-hanging fruit. We can eat lower on the food web, which reduces our demand for beef and other grain-intensive meats that makes more grain available for others. So, you know, even in developed countries, we eat far too much meat, eat far too many calories as it is. So cutting back on our own consumption is enormously important. And the biggest thing, I think, and the thing that I stress in the last chapter of the book, is we need to foment a pink revolution in many parts of the world. And what I mean by this is we need to help these countries where women still on average have 5 to 7 children during their lifetime make the demographic transition to having 2 or 3, getting their fertility rates down to replacement value. And we do this fairly simply by educating girls through at least the 6th grade, ideally through high school. And by educating women, giving them equal rights to men in many of these countries, you unleash an enormous amount of potential for half of their population. And we've seen that every time they get, you know, have access to family planning services, have access to contraceptives, and are educated to at least the 6th grade, fertility rates drop on their own without sort of draconian one-child policies or forced sterilizations that we saw in the 60s and 70s. It's sort of just the natural trend. And if we can do anything we can to help that, then we'll be doing them a favor and helping, and, you know, liberate their women, and we'll be doing ourselves a favor by helping them become more self-sufficient.
Well, Joel, as we wrap up, one last question. What are you working on now?
Oh, I've got a number of things. I'm currently working on a story for Geographic on the rush to the Arctic and the resources we're trying to extract as climate change is melting the ice up there, and what the impacts that could have on our global climate, which could be profound. So, yeah, I've been spending a lot of time in very cold places lately.
Joel K. Buren has the most complete and authoritative work I've seen on the giant subject of world food. It's called The End of Plenty, The Race to Feed a Crowded World. Anyone who cares about the future should read it, in my opinion. You can find out more at joelkburen.com, and you'll get more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I know you've been swamped with interviews, Joel, so thanks so much for taking the time to join us on this important subject.
Alex, it's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.